It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Spring is typically a big season for construction in Pittsburgh, but the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation has lost more than a month of scheduled work since the shutdown began. District 11 Executive Cheryl Moon Sirianni, who oversees maintenance across Allegheny, Beaver, and Lawrence counties, says PennDOT is moving on 23 of its 100 scheduled projects, mostly to repair areas still affected by last year's landslides and where there's a critical safety issue that simply can't wait. Many others remain on hold. Those include paving on 51 outside of the Fort Pitt Tunnel and both sides of Carson Street, which she says now definitely won't be done by June. I asked her yesterday how she plans to triage other works when Governor Tom Wolf ultimately moves to reopen Pennsylvania.
I mean, I think we all heard the governor say that he's hoping that, you know, we can start all of our construction projects back up May 8th. So that's all the active construction projects that we had going are going to start hopefully right shortly after May 8th. But we're not quite sure where what the budget implications may be for some of the other work that we had planned towards the end of the year. We're actually evaluating that right now as we speak, seeing about the loss of revenue. People haven't been traveling. That's how obviously PennDOT makes its money, through liquid fuels funds. So we need to evaluate exactly what our losses might be and see where we might fall with some of these projects. What you may see not occur are some slide projects on lower volume roads, some paving projects that we just can't afford at this time might have to be pushed back a year. So we are evaluating all of that right now. Any critical safety concerns will continue to be addressed, though.
Before you begin normal construction, normal work on these and other scheduled maintenance and rehab projects, what safety precautions are you taking in terms of this outbreak?
Well, in order to get started back on any of the projects, there's a requirement that the contractor has to provide a COVID safety procedure plan that has to be reviewed by the department before anybody can come onto the site. We're really changing how we're doing business, both from a construction and a construction inspection standpoint. Obviously, the masks are having to be worn. Cleaning stations are put in place. There's specific requirements on who's operating what equipment and how it has to be cleaned in between. They're trying to perform social distancing as much as they can. What activities can they do where they don't have to be in small groups? Can they do these with like one person in a machine and one person out on the site? So some of the slide projects, that's quite easy. You have, you know, person and equipment and then people down on the road, not right next to each other. Some of the other projects are going to be a little bit more difficult. A paving project where you have 20 people gathered around a paver, it could be a little bit more difficult to do the social distancing. So we're actually asking the contractors to give us a plan on how they can do that safely.
Long term, how will any delays that you've experienced to this point affect your crews and our roadways? Can you reasonably make up the lost time?
No, we can't really make up the lost time. What we're doing is, I mean, our contractors are trying to practice the most safe processes that they can. And some of those safe processes require to have less crews on site, maybe working less hours. So we are, you know, we can't really say let's throw everybody out there and try to get these done on the same schedule, because we're trying to avoid throwing everybody out on a project. So we have to be very careful to that. Some instances we maybe can make up time on some of, like I said, these slides where you don't have to have as many people working at one time. There might be an opportunity to do that. The projects that haven't started, though, we probably, by May 8th, we're probably going to lose about a month and a half, 2 months on some of those. So making up that amount of time could be a little bit difficult. On the flip side, we don't have a lot of traffic right now. We don't have a lot of the events planned in the city, which is actually not a good thing, but it's a good thing from a traffic perspective and a construction perspective, that we might not have to worry about working around some of these events, which may give us some more weekends, some more nights to get some of the work done.
Cheryl Moon Sirianni is PennDOT's District 11 Executive. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State and federal officials are beginning to imagine life after coronavirus. So what could that look like day by day? The Confluence's Megan Harris talked about next steps with Johns Hopkins University infectious disease expert, Dr. Amesh Adalja.
What do you make of the numbers that we're seeing either at the state level or nationally right now about coronavirus? How are we doing?
You have to realize that this is a community spreading respiratory virus. So cases are going to go up. It's not going to magically disappear. And social distancing will keep it at bay for some time. But as you ease social distancing, case numbers are going to go up. We did not get a major surge in southwestern Pennsylvania. There's sort of been a rolling number of cases that have been manageable pretty easily by the hospital system. We will expect to see cases go up and also deaths to increase, because this is just the nature of this. You're not going to be able to completely contain it or stop it. It's just, can you control the number of cases, the speed at which they're occurring?
Governor Tom Wolf says it'll be at least May 8th before Pennsylvania makes a move. Other states like Georgia, meanwhile, say they're going to kick things off this week. What do you make of this? Is it too soon?
It's too soon to go back to what it was in December, for example. But I do think that it is time to start thinking about how to do this safely and even to start taking some actions and trying to get things back to normal. And if you look at Pennsylvania, it's very heterogeneous. It's not the same thing in some of the rural counties as it is in Philadelphia County or those suburbs. So there may be actions that you can take in some of those areas to allow people to get back to life. Obviously, things like mass gatherings are still going to be very difficult to have because of the sheer number of people and the opportunity the virus can have. But thinking about how to allow more businesses to open, lifting stay-at-home orders, thinking about what other types of activities can be done safely. Maybe you have to modify things at restaurants. Maybe you keep the tables farther apart. You decrease the occupancy, all of that type of stuff. We're sort of in that phase now in many states in the country, and I think we'll see more of it.
How would you say that our state and local governments have responded up to this point? Are there places where the government response went too far or didn't go far enough?
This is a hard question to answer because there's not really black or white here. It's a lot of gray, and there are a lot of actions that governors and governments can take that are controversial in my own field. For example, school closure. That's something that is very controversial, but every governor basically took that in the country. But we don't know what the role of children are in the epidemiology, meaning how well they spread this virus to others. Pennsylvania is a complicated state with the fact that you have Philadelphia, which is more demographically similar and in population density similar to New York than it is than the rest of the state.
Well, so as you look ahead, what kinds of data are you paying attention to? There's a lot of metrics floating around about the virus. What, to your mind, is most important, especially as our lawmakers decide how and when to make decisions around reopening?
The number one thing has to be hospital capacity, because that's what all of this flattening the curve is about. Do they have enough ICU beds? Do they have enough mechanical ventilators? Do they have enough personal protective equipment? When you relax social distancing, you have to expect that there are going to be more cases. And then you gauge, were those cases too much for the hospital system to handle? If not, then you can peel something else back. That's basically the way that you would do this in an evidence-based manner. Because this isn't a virus that goes anywhere. This is a virus that's what we say endemic in the human population. It's still going to spread when you lift social distancing. It's not magically going to disappear.
Johns Hopkins University infectious disease expert, Dr. Amesh Adalja, thanks so much.
Thanks.
I'm Megan Harris.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This week, the coronavirus pandemic claimed an iconic Pittsburgh restaurant, with the apparent permanent closure of Essie's original hot dog shop in Oakland, known as The O. But while most local restaurants have survived so far, they face an uncertain future. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll has more.
Dinette is a beloved restaurant in East Liberty known for its gourmet pizzas and sunlit dining area. Local chef Sonia Finn founded it in 2008. She closed it March 15th, the day after Allegheny County reported its first case of COVID-19, she says.
For the public health, but also I don't think my employees should have to risk their health and the health of their families.
The next day, Governor Wolf required all restaurants in the county to cease dine-in service, an order that soon went statewide. About half of Pennsylvania's restaurants remain open for takeout and delivery, but Finn thought even that was too risky. She laid off all 11 of her employees and has spent 6 weeks watching her losses grow.
Zero income and coming in and zero revenue and lots of bills piling up. So, yeah.
The toll is substantial.
I knew that by the end of the month, I would have $20,000 due in bills that couldn't be paid.
That was for March.
And I also knew, or know now, that each month I'm not open is $10,000 in fixed costs. So I'm just going deeper in debt. My $10,000 each month.
Statewide, restaurants report an 80% decline in sales from this time last year, according to the National Restaurant Association. And they've laid off or furloughed more than 330,000 workers. With everyone following stay-home orders, takeout and delivery are up, but it's not enough. Herky Pollock is a co-owner of the Burgatory chain.
It's probably between around 15% of our normal revenue, 15 to 20% in some cases.
Burgatory is big by Pittsburgh standards, with 7 full-service locations. Pollock says the restaurant laid off 450 part-time workers, but all 180 full-timers remain on staff.
We're taking some losses, yes, but we're doing it largely to keep our full-time employees employed with the hopes that one day we'll come out of this and be able to reopen to the public, and we'll have our key staff and be raring to go at that point.
Burgatory has had help. It tapped the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, part of the federal government's pandemic aid package for small businesses. The PPP is a loan, but it's forgiven if at least 75% of the total goes toward paying employees. Other programs used by restaurants include an emergency disaster loan, the first $10,000 of which doesn't have to be repaid. Still, programs like the PPP were devised hastily, and restaurant owners, including dinette Sonia Finn, say its rules are unclear.
No loans like this have ever happened before, and there's so much confusion about them.
Many restaurateurs say they're unsure about how exactly to spend the funds so the loans are forgiven. John Longstreet heads the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. He says the confusion is understandable.
The concept of PPP was to put people back on the payroll, not necessarily bring them back to work.
PPP was designed as an alternative to unemployment compensation, but it's not worked out for everyone, Longstreet says. Some workers who receive unemployment plus a weekly $600 federal benefit have declined to return to their restaurant jobs under PPP, he says.
They're actually making as much as they were making before or more. And they're saying, you know, I don't need to come to work now.
Many restaurant owners add that with their businesses scaled back or shuttered, their real need is meeting expenses beyond payroll. Dinette Finn.
The focus should be on money to support the small business to pay its fixed costs, rent, insurance, utilities, health insurance for employees, so that the business can stay afloat with no revenue coming in.
Longstreet says industry is working with government to correct such issues in the expected next round of federal coronavirus relief. Money for the PPP and the disaster loan have both run out. The industry also wants to extend benefits past June 30th. That's the date PPP benefits expire, but there's no guarantee restaurants will be back at full capacity by then. Restaurant owners hope they can hold on.
I think there should be more awareness of how important small businesses are going forward.
Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. April is National Poetry Month. It's the time of the year when poetry enthusiasts come together to celebrate the craft. But in times of social distancing, that can be tricky. Keystone Crossroads' Sojourner Ahebe has this story of poets in Pennsylvania trying to foster community during a pandemic.
Anthony Orozco's poetry was born from a feeling of isolation. He grew up biracial in a rural, mostly white area in Ohio.
My father is a dark and, you know, indigenous Mexican, mestizo Mexican. My mother is, a paper white Appalachian woman. And, you know, just like in any middle school situation, you get picked on for anything that's different.
After one particularly bad bullying incident, Orozco was taken under the wing by a few teachers who encouraged him to use poetry to express his feelings.
They gave me, you know, just little boosts, a little boost of confidence for my skills and encouraged me to dig a little deeper. And I really liked it. And it, I don't know, something clicked.
He's lived in Reading since 2012 and has become a leader of the local poetry scene. With the pandemic in full swing, he's taking his poetry workshops virtual, and every day of National Poetry Month, he's posting on social media a video of a local poet reading their work. Current Berks County Poet Laureate Jane Brown and local Reading poet Jules Grace are among some of those voices.
Where the avenue becomes a street, the river speaks.
Every drop of her bloody time, every bleeding second, out to make sure tú estás bien.
Plans had been in place to stage a live poetry exhibition throughout the city of Reading, but that had to be shelved. Instead, Orozco gathered materials from local poets and just published a new anthology online.
The internet is obviously the most accessible thing right now. That's what's connecting everybody to each other.
This sort of pivot is happening in poetry circles across the state. Former City Poet Laureate Yolanda Wisher is a Philadelphia-based curator and educator.
Doors are closing. Next stop, Love Jones, a mixtape.
She hosts Love Johns, which she describes as an anti-podcast, perfect for a brief commute or moment of transition. With the pandemic in full force, Wisher wonders if she'll even need a physical studio when this is all over.
So usually we have people come into a studio and record poems. You know, for this last episode, we obviously couldn't do that. And so we just kind of created a little DIY recording tip sheet for folks.
She says the pandemic has allowed for time to slow down, which she's using to catch up on reading.
I have a stack of stuff by my bed. I'm reading Meridian by Alice Walker. My mom just got me the new Zora Neale Hurston collection of short stories.
For Anthony Orozco in Reading, virtual poetry is a challenge. There's just less intimacy compared to face-to-face interactions.
You know, in these workshops, I mean, like, people are tearing up. People are sharing the most vulnerable parts of themselves. Sometimes that's lost in virtual space.
Poems exist in a continuum between the poet and the audience. That's where the magic happens. Despite the pandemic, Orozco says that magic is still happening online.
This is a battle cry. This is a defiant burst of joy. You know, this is springtime. Having the audacity to show up so well-dressed in the middle of a funeral, you know? This is power of life beaming through uncertainty and fear.
Sojourner Ahebe, Keystone Crossroads.
And for today, that is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovic, Kylie Kozinski, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Please be safe, and I hope you have a good day of good news.